The Origin of the Universe, a lecture given at the 300 Years of Gravity Conference held in Cambridge in June 1987 on the 300th anniversary of the publication of Newton's Principia. The problem of the origin of the universe is a bit like the old question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? In other words, what agency created the universe, and what created that agency? Or perhaps the universe or the agency that created it existed forever and didn't need to be created. Up to recently, scientists have tended to shy away from such questions, feeling that they belong to metaphysics or religion rather than to science. In the last few years, however, it has emerged that the laws of science may hold even at the beginning of the universe. In that case, the universe could be self-contained and determined completely by the laws of science. The debate about whether and how the universe began has been going on throughout recorded history. Basically, there were two schools of thought. Many early traditions, and the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic religions, held that the universe was created in the fairly recent past. In the 17th century, Bishop Usher calculated a date of 4004 BC for the creation of the universe, a figure he arrived at by adding up the ages of people in the Old Testament. One fact that was used to support the idea of a recent origin was the recognition that the human race is obviously evolving in culture and technology. We remember who first performed that deed or developed this technique. Thus, the argument runs, we cannot have been around all that long. Otherwise, we would have already progressed more than we have. In fact, the biblical date for the creation is not that far off the date of the end of the last ice age, which is when modern humans seem first to have appeared. On the other hand, there were people such as the Greek philosopher Aristotle who didn't like the idea that the universe had a beginning. They felt that would imply divine intervention. They preferred to believe that the universe had existed and would exist forever. Something that was eternal was more perfect than something that had to be created. They had an answer to the argument about human progress described above. Periodic floods or other natural disasters had repeatedly set the human race right back to the beginning. Both schools of thought held that the universe was essentially unchanging with time. Either it was created in its present form, or it has endured forever as it is today. This was a natural belief, because human life, indeed the whole of recorded history, is so brief that during it the universe has not changed significantly. In a static, unchanging universe, the question of whether it has existed forever or whether it was created at a finite time in the past is really a matter for metaphysics or religion. Either theory could account for such a universe. Indeed, in 1781, the philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote a monumental and very obscure work, The Critique of Pure Reason, in which he concluded that there were equally valid arguments both for believing that the universe had a beginning and for believing that it did not. As his title suggests, his conclusions were based simply on reason. In other words, they did not take any account of observations of the universe. After all, in an unchanging universe, what was there to observe? In the 19th century, however, evidence began to accumulate that the Earth and the rest of the universe were in fact changing with time. Geologists realized that the formation of the rocks and the fossils in them would have taken hundreds or thousands of millions of years. This was far longer than the age of the Earth as calculated by the creationists. Further evidence was provided by the so-called second law of thermodynamics, formulated by the German physicist Ludwig Boltzmann. It states that the total amount of disorder in the universe, which is measured by a quantity called entropy, always increases with time. This, like the argument about human progress, suggests that the universe can have been going only for a finite time. Otherwise, it would by now have degenerated into a state of complete disorder, in which everything would be at the same temperature. Another difficulty with the idea of a static universe was that according to Newton's law of gravity, each star in the universe ought to be attracted toward every other star. If so, how could they stay motionless at a constant distance from each other? Wouldn't they all fall together? Newton was aware of this problem. In a letter to Richard Bentley, a leading philosopher of the time, he agreed that a finite collection of stars could not remain motionless. They would all fall together to some central point. However, he argued, an infinite collection of stars would not fall together, for there would not be any central point for them to fall to. This argument is an example of the pitfalls that one can encounter when one talks about infinite systems. By using different ways to add up the forces on each star from the infinite number of other stars in the universe, one can get different answers to the question of whether the stars can remain at constant distances from each other. We now know that the correct procedure is to consider the case of a finite region of stars, and then to add more stars distributed roughly uniformly outside the region. A finite collection of stars will fall together, and according to Newton's law, adding more stars outside the region will not stop the collapse. Thus, an infinite collection of stars cannot remain in a motionless state. If they're not moving relative to each other at one time, the attraction between them will cause them to start falling toward each other. Alternatively, they can be moving away from each other with gravity slowing down the velocity of the recession. Despite these difficulties with the idea of a static and unchanging universe, no one in the 17th, 18th, 19th, or early 20th century suggested that the universe might be evolving with time. Newton and Einstein both missed the chance of predicting that the universe should be either contracting or expanding. One cannot really hold it against Newton because he lived 250 years before the observational discovery of the expansion of the universe. But Einstein should have known better. The theory of general relativity he formulated in 1915 predicted that the universe was expanding. But he remained so convinced of a static universe that he added an element to his theory to reconcile it with Newton's theory and balance gravity. The discovery of the expansion of the universe by Edwin Hubble in 1929 completely changed the discussion about its origin. If you take the present notion of the galaxies and run it back in time, it would seem that they should all have been on top of each other at some moment between 10 and 20,000 million years ago. At this time, a singularity called the Big Bang, the density of the universe and the curvature of space-time, would have been infinite. Under such conditions, all the known laws of science would break down. This is a disaster for science. It would mean that science alone could not predict how the universe began. All that science could say is the universe is as it is now because it was as it was then. But science could not explain why it was as it was just after the Big Bang. Not surprisingly, many scientists were unhappy with this conclusion. There were thus several attempts to avoid the conclusion that there must have been a Big Bang singularity and hence a beginning of time. One was the so-called steady-state theory. The idea was that as the galaxies moved apart from each other, new galaxies would form in the spaces in between from matter that was continually being created. The universe existed and would continue to exist forever in more or less the same state as it is today. For the universe to continue to expand and new matter be created, the steady-state model required a modification of general relativity. But the rate of creation needed was very low, about one particle per cubic kilometer per year, which would not conflict with observation. The theory also predicted that the average density of galaxies and similar objects should be constant both in space and time. However, a survey of sources of radio waves outside our galaxy, carried out by Martin Ryle and his group at Cambridge, showed that there were many more faint sources than strong ones. On average, one would expect the faint sources to be the more distant ones. There were thus two possibilities. Either we are in a region of the universe in which strong sources are less frequent than the average, or the density of sources was higher in the past when the light left the more distant sources on its journey toward us. Neither of these possibilities was compatible with the prediction of the steady-state theory that the density of radio sources should be constant in space and time. The final blow to the theory was the discovery in 1964 by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson of a background of microwave radiation from far beyond our galaxy. This had the characteristic spectrum of radiation emitted by a hot body, though in this case the term hot is hardly appropriate, since the temperature was only 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. The universe is a cold, dark place. There was no reasonable mechanism in the steady-state theory to generate microwaves with such a spectrum. The theory, therefore, had to be abandoned. Another idea that would avoid a Big Bang singularity was suggested by two Russian scientists, Yevgeny Lifshitz and Isaac Kolatnikov, in 1963. They said that a state of infinite density might occur only if the galaxies were moving directly toward or away from each other. Only then would they all have met up at a single point in the past. However, the galaxies would also have had some small sideways velocities, and this might have made it possible for there to have been an earlier contracting phase of the universe in which the galaxies might have come very close together, but somehow managed to avoid hitting each other. The universe might then have re-expanded without going through a state of infinite density. When Lifshitz and Kolatnikov made their suggestion, I was a research student looking for a problem with which to complete my PhD thesis. I was interested in the question of whether there had been a Big Bang singularity, because that was crucial to an understanding of the origin of the universe. Together with Roger Penrose, I developed a new set of mathematical techniques for dealing with this and similar problems. We showed that if general relativity is correct, any reasonable model of the universe must start with a singularity. This would mean that science could predict that the universe must have had a beginning, but that it could not predict how the universe should begin. For that, one would have to appeal to God. It's been interesting to watch the change in the climate of opinion on singularities. When I was a graduate student, almost no one took them seriously. Now, as a result of the singularity theorems, nearly everyone believes that the universe began with a singularity, at which the laws of physics broke down. However, I now think that although there is a singularity, the laws of physics can still determine how the universe began. The general theory of relativity is what is called a classical theory. That is, it doesn't take into account the fact that particles do not have precisely defined positions and velocities, but are smeared out over a small region by the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics that doesn't allow us to measure simultaneously both the position and the velocity. This doesn't matter in normal situations because the radius of curvature of space-time is very large compared to the uncertainty in the position of a particle. However, the singularity theorems indicate that space-time will be highly distorted, with a small radius of curvature at the beginning of the present expansion phase of the universe. In this situation, the uncertainty principle will be very important. Thus, general relativity brings about its own downfall by predicting singularities. In order to discuss the beginning of the universe, we need a theory that combines general relativity with quantum mechanics. That theory is quantum gravity. We don't yet know the exact form the correct theory of quantum gravity will take. The best candidate we have at the moment is the theory of superstrings, but there are still a number of unresolved difficulties. However, certain features can be expected to be present in any viable theory. One is Einstein's idea that the effects of gravity can be represented by a space-time that is curved or distorted, warped by the matter and energy in it. Objects try to follow the nearest thing to a straight line in this curved space. However, because it is curved, their paths appear to be bent, as if by a gravitational field. Another element that we expect to be present in the ultimate theory is Richard Feynman's proposal that quantum theory can be formulated as a sum over histories. In its simplest form, the idea is that every particle has every possible path or history in space-time. Each path or history has a probability that depends on its shape. For this idea to work, one has to consider histories that take place in imaginary time, rather than in the real time in which we perceive ourselves as living. Imaginary time may sound like something out of science fiction, but it is a well-defined mathematical concept. In a sense, it can be thought of as a direction of time that is at right angles to real time. One adds up the probabilities for all the particle histories with certain properties, such as passing through certain points at certain times. One then has to extrapolate the result back to the real space-time in which we live. This is not the most familiar approach to quantum theory, but it gives the same results as other methods. In the case of quantum gravity, Feynman's idea of a sum over histories would involve summing over different possible histories for the universe, that is, different curved space-times. These would represent the history of the universe and everything in it. One has to specify what class of possible curved spaces should be included in the sum over histories. The choice of this class of spaces determines what state the universe is in. If the class of curved spaces that defines the state of the universe included spaces with singularities, the probabilities of such spaces would not be determined by the theory. Instead, the probabilities would have to be assigned in some arbitrary way. What this means is that science could not predict the probabilities of such singular histories for space-time. Thus, it could not predict how the universe should behave. It is possible, however, that the universe is in a state defined by a sum that includes only non-singular curved spaces. In this case, the laws of science would determine the universe completely. One would not have to appeal to some agency external to the universe to determine how it began. In a way, the proposal that the state of the universe is determined by a sum over only non-singular histories is like the drunk looking for his key under the lamppost. It may not be where he lost it, but it is the only place where he might find it. Similarly, the universe may not be in the state defined by a sum over non-singular histories, but it is the only state in which science could predict how the universe should be. In 1983, Jim Hartle and I proposed that the state of the universe should be given by a sum over a certain class of histories. This class consisted of curved spaces without singularities, which were of finite size, but which did not have boundaries or edges. They would be like the surface of the Earth, but with two more dimensions. The surface of the Earth has a finite area, but it doesn't have any singularities, boundaries, or edges. I've tested this by experiment. I went around the world, and I didn't fall off. The proposal that Hartle and I made can be paraphrased as, the boundary condition of the universe is that it has no boundary. It is only if the universe is in this no-boundary state that the laws of science, on their own, determine the probabilities of each possible history. Thus, it is only in this case that the known laws would determine how the universe should behave. If the universe is in any other state, the class of curved spaces and the sum over histories will include spaces with singularities. In order to determine the probabilities of such singular histories, one would have to invoke some principle other than the known laws of science. This principle would be something external to our universe. We could not deduce it from within our universe. On the other hand, if the universe is in the no-boundary state, we could, in principle, determine completely how the universe should behave, up to the limits of the uncertainty principle. It would clearly be nice for science if the universe were in the no-boundary state, but how can we tell whether it is? The answer is that the no-boundary proposal makes definite predictions for how the universe should behave. If these predictions were not to agree with observation, we could conclude that the universe is not in the no-boundary state. Thus, the no-boundary proposal is a good scientific theory, in the sense defined by the philosopher Karl Popper. It can be disproved or falsified by observation. If the observations do not agree with the predictions, we will know that there must be singularities in the class of possible histories. However, that is about all we would know. We would not be able to calculate the probabilities of the singular histories. Thus, we would not be able to predict how the universe should behave. One might think that this unpredictability wouldn't matter too much if it occurred only at the Big Bang. After all, that was 10 or 20 billion years ago. But if predictability broke down in the very strong gravitational fields in the Big Bang, it could also break down whenever a star collapsed. This could happen several times a week in our galaxy alone. Our power of prediction would be poor, even by the standards of weather forecasts. Of course, one could say one need not care about the breakdown in predictability that occurred in a distant star. However, in quantum theory, anything that is not actually forbidden can and will happen. Thus, if the class of possible histories includes spaces with singularities, these singularities could occur anywhere, not just at the Big Bang and in collapsing stars. This would mean that we couldn't predict anything. Conversely, the fact that we're able to predict events is experimental evidence against singularities and for the no-boundary proposal. So, what does the no-boundary proposal predict for the universe? The first point to make is that because all the possible histories for the universe are finite in extent, any quantity that one uses as a measure of time will have a greatest and a least value. Thus, the universe will have a beginning and an end. The beginning in real time will be the Big Bang singularity. However, the beginning in imaginary time will not be a singularity. Instead, it will be a bit like the North Pole of the Earth. If one takes degrees of latitude on the surface of the Earth to be the analog of time, one could say that the surface of the Earth begins at the North Pole. Yet the North Pole is a perfectly ordinary point on the Earth. There's nothing special about it. And the same laws hold at the North Pole as at other places on the Earth. Similarly, the event that we might choose to label as the beginning of the universe in imaginary time would be an ordinary point of space-time, much like any other. The laws of science would hold at the beginning as elsewhere. From the analogy with the surface of the Earth, one might expect that the end of the universe would be similar to the beginning, just as the North Pole is much like the South Pole. However, the North and South Poles correspond to the beginning and end of the history of the universe in imaginary time, not in the real time that we experience. If one extrapolates the results of the sum over histories from imaginary time to real time, one finds that the beginning of the universe in real time can be very different from its end. Jonathan Halliwell and I have made an approximate calculation of what the no-boundary condition would imply. We treated the universe as a perfectly smooth and uniform background on which there were small perturbations of density. In real time, the universe would appear to begin its expansion at a very small radius. At first, the expansion would be what is called inflationary, that is, the universe would double in size every fraction of a second, just as prices double every year in certain countries. The world record for economic inflation was probably Germany after the First World War, where the price of a loaf of bread went from under a mark to millions of marks in a few months. But that is nothing compared to the inflation that seems to have occurred in the early universe. An increase in size by a factor of at least a million, 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 million times in a tiny fraction of a second. Of course, that was before the present government. The inflation was a good thing in that it produced a universe that was smooth and uniform on a large scale, and was expanding at just the critical rate to avoid recollapse. The inflation was also a good thing in that it produced all the contents of the universe quite literally out of nothing. When the universe was a single point, like the North Pole, it contained nothing. Yet there are now at least 10 to the 80th particles in the part of the universe that we can observe. Where did all these particles come from? The answer is that relativity and quantum mechanics allow matter to be created out of energy in the form of particle-antiparticle pairs. And where did the energy come from to create this matter? The answer is that it was borrowed from the gravitational energy of the universe. The universe has an enormous debt of negative gravitational energy, which exactly balances the positive energy of the matter. During the inflationary period, the universe borrowed heavily from its gravitational energy to finance the creation of more matter. The result was a triumph for Keynesian economics, a vigorous and expanding universe filled with material objects. The debt of gravitational energy will not have to be paid until the end of the universe. The early universe could not have been completely homogeneous and uniform, because that would violate the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics. Instead, there must have been departures from uniform density. The no-boundary proposal implies that these differences in density would start off in their ground state. That is, they would be as small as possible, consistent with the uncertainty principle. During the inflationary expansion, however, the differences would be amplified. After the period of inflationary expansion was over, one would be left with a universe that was expanding slightly faster in some places than in others. In regions of slower expansion, the gravitational attraction of the matter would slow down the expansion still further. Eventually, the region would stop expanding and would contract to form galaxies and stars. Thus, the no-boundary proposal can account for all the complicated structure that we see around us. However, it does not make just a single prediction for the universe. Instead, it predicts a whole family of possible histories, each with its own probability. There might be a possible history in which the Labour Party won the last election in Britain, though maybe the probability is low. The no-boundary proposal has profound implications for the role of God in the affairs of the universe. It is now generally accepted that the universe evolves according to well-defined laws. These laws may have been ordained by God, but it seems that he does not intervene in the universe to break the laws. Until recently, however, it was thought that these laws did not apply to the beginning of the universe. It would be up to God to wind up the clockwork and set the universe going in any way he wanted. Thus, the present state of the universe would be the result of God's choice of the initial conditions. The situation would be very different, however, if something like the no-boundary proposal were correct. In that case, the laws of physics would hold even at the beginning of the universe, so God would not have had the freedom to choose the initial conditions. Of course, he would still have been free to choose the laws that the universe obeyed. However, this may not have been much of a choice. There may be only a small number of laws which are self-consistent and which lead to complicated beings like ourselves who can ask the question, what is the nature of God? And even if there is only one unique set of possible laws, it is only a set of equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to govern? Is the ultimate unified theory so compelling that it brings about its own existence? Although science may solve the problem of how the universe began, it cannot answer the question, why does the universe bother to exist? I don't know the answer to that.